From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, deadly car bombing in Mali. Drivers in Cameroon in supply runs to the CAR. Sunni insurgents on the move in Iraq, plus the World Cup gets underway today in Brazil. We'll take you there. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A suicide attack at a UN camp in northern Mali has killed four peacekeepers, raised concerns of heightened instability as the government there tries to recover from the 2012 Islamist militant takeover in the country's north. Six other UN peacekeepers were wounded, along with four Malian soldiers. There was no claim of responsibility. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, meantime, in his office, condemned the attack in the strongest terms, and in a statement late on Wednesday, a spokesperson for Mr. Ban said the attack would not diminish the UN's resolve to support Mali in its efforts to achieve peace and stability. Truck drivers who transport humanitarian aid from Cameroon to the troubled Central African Republic have halted deliveries after suspected Salika rebels attacked three and killed their colleagues. The truckers say they will not go back to work unless authorities and the CAR can assure them of their safety. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde.
Frustrated drivers are expressing anger that African peacekeepers in the Central African Republic have not protected them from the country's rebels and militia groups. One of the drivers, 52-year-old Danjuma Bello, tells VOA that he had taken the advice of the Transporters Union and will not carry goods to the CAR.
On nous a surpris comme ça là, et puis nous abandonnant les camions.
He says they were taken unaware when armed men attacked them and started shooting. He says his vehicle has holes while bullets penetrated. Bello says he narrowly missed death in last Sunday's attack, but three of his peers were killed. The drivers who transport food, relief items and other goods from Cameroon's seaport Douala say they have been victims of persistent attacks from both Seleka rebels and their anti-Balaka rivals. The president of the drivers' union, El Hajj Umaru, tells VOA that after the incident, he ordered union members to halt their deliveries.
Il s'agit encore une fois de mort d'homme. Notre chauffeur a été froidement égorgé. Pour le moment, nous avons.
He says their drivers were slaughtered and they suspended the transportation of goods to the CAR to bury their dead before examining what to do next. The union is insisting that African peacekeepers accompany and protect the drivers on the road into the capital, Bangui. Umaru says if that doesn't happen, the CAR may not be getting supplies by road for a long time to come. The landlocked CAR depends on the Douala seaport for about 95% of its supplies. For now, only a number of truckers who are not members of the union still brave the road to Bangui. 20 truck drivers have been killed along the road to Bangui since the unrest in the CAR began. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaounde.
Officials in northeastern Nigeria are disputing reports that Boko Haram militants kidnapped 20 women from a village near Chibok, where more than 200 girls were nabbed in April. In a phone interview with VOA's House of Service, the Borno State Police Commissioner, Wawal Tonko, said local police are unaware of any abduction. And the chairman of Chibok's local government, Ben Lawan, also told VOA he had not heard anything about kidnapping. The Associated Press reported Boko Haram militants abducted 20 women late last week from a small settlement a few kilometers from Chibok. Story quoted a number of local vigilante groups as saying the women were forced into cars at gunpoint and driven away to an unknown location. The AP tells VOA that it's standing by its story. An Egyptian court sentenced prominent activist Ala Abdel Fattah and 24 others to 15 years in prison on Wednesday in a continuing government crackdown on dissent. Abdel Fattah and his colleagues were convicted of protesting a restrictive protest law last November. Legislative human rights groups have called repressive. They were also charged with attacking a police officer and disturbing the peace. The activist was tried in absentia after security forces barred him and two other defendants from attending their trial. The three were arrested outside the court after the sentence was handed down. At Wednesday's news briefing, U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki reacted to the government crackdown on dissent in Egypt.
We share the view of Egyptian civil society representatives that this law, which imposes restrictions on Egypt's ability to assemble peacefully and express their views, does not meet international standards and will not move Egypt's democratic transition forward. And as is the case in any of these circumstances, we will continue to express that to the relevant officials in Egypt.
Abd El Fattah rose to prominence during the 2011 uprising that toppled longtime President Hosni Mubarak. He has since been active in trying to bring an end to military trials of civilians and other civilian rights causes. Wednesday's sentences are the first against pro-democracy activists since the inauguration of President Abd El Fattah el-Sisi on Sunday. A leading activist group is calling for the South African government to declare the country's tuberculosis epidemic a public health emergency. The Treatment Action Campaign made the plea this week at South Africa's fourth TB conference in Durban. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Treatment Action Campaign says TB is the leading cause of death in adults and children. Marcus Lowe is the group's head of policy.
South Africa has the highest TB infection rate on the planet. So in terms of absolute numbers, China and India have higher numbers. But when you take the size of our population into account, South Africa has the highest rates. And that is largely driven by our high HIV rates.
HIV attacks the immune system, making people more susceptible to TB infection. However, while TB is closely tied to HIV, it has not generated the same response.
HIV is a disease that had a significant footprint in the U.S. and Europe, so there was a lot of drug development. But TB is really a disease of poor countries, so we don't have the same investment in research and development. So we're really facing a pretty serious crisis in South Africa. We have in the region of 450,000 new infections every year, and it's the number one cause of natural death in South Africa.
The Treatment Action Campaign gained prominence in South Africa in the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. It helped wage a major legal battle against the government and drug companies to make antiretrovirals more available.
We want to see the same kind of widespread social mobilization that we had around HIV, around TB. Now, in some ways, it's a bit more complicated because with HIV, if you provide people with treatment and they take it, they get well. With TB, there are many more social factors that makes it much harder to deal with.
Lowe says one of those social factors is TB among South Africa's prison population.
We have a lot of overcrowded correctional facilities in South Africa, often cells with over 200% occupancy. So that creates the ideal environment for the spread of TB and, of course, drug-resistant forms of TB. So to deal with something like that, it's not just a matter for the Department of Health. It's a matter that the Department of Justice has to look at how many people we are incarcerating. The prison system has to be reformed to ensure that we have better infection control.
South Africa's National Strategic Plan for HIV, STIs, and TB does list tuberculosis as a priority, and the country's health minister is scheduled to address the TB conference on Friday. The Treatment Action Campaign's Marcus Lowe says it can be difficult getting a national strategy implemented on the local level.
South Africa has 9 provinces, and these provinces have significant autonomy in what they do. So whereas national policy may be good, these policies may not be implemented in the various provinces. That's one kind of problem we face. The other thing is that if you want to fix the problem of TB in prisons, as I explained earlier, you need other government departments to get involved, and that unfortunately hasn't been happening in recent years.
South Africa has been getting more HIV-infected people on treatment. That also offers an opportunity to screen them for TB. In its call for a TB public health emergency, the Treatment Action Campaign says we can continue to let people die of preventable TB or we can act with urgency and determination to defeat it. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Sierra Leone doubled its death toll from the highly contagious Ebola virus this week, and international aid organizations are also struggling to contain the deadly epidemic's grip on West Africa. Two of the new deaths were health workers in an eastern district near the border with Guinea, which is the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak, where more than 200 people have died since the beginning of January. No medicine, no vaccine exists right now for Ebola, which is named after a small river in the Democratic Republic of Congo. UN's health agency said Wednesday it has so far registered 328 confirmed or suspected cases of Ebola in Guinea, including 208 deaths, with 21 deaths registered between May 29th and June 1st alone. Virus appears to have resurfaced in neighboring Liberia, which earlier this year had seen 12 suspected and confirmed cases of Ebola, including 9 deaths, but had not seen any new cases for nearly 2 months.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Also in the news, Iraqi security officials say Islamist militants who took over the city of Mosul on Tuesday have seized the city of Tikrit, less than 200 kilometers from Baghdad. The officials said militants from the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant have moved southward from Mosul, taking control of Iraq's biggest oil refinery, and Tikrit, the hometown of fallen Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Witnesses are also saying the militants have taken over several police stations and that the governor is missing. Militants continue to hold Iraq's second-largest city, Mosul, as both Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the region's provincial governor called on residents to fight to retake it. Prime Minister Maliki spoke about what he thinks was a police conspiracy in Mosul that allowed the city to fall.
I am saying a conspiracy because the numbers of al-Qaeda and ISIL forces could not have confronted the army and police forces that were located there. But what has happened? And how have the military units collapsed?
In the southern Shiite city of Basra on Wednesday, a car bomb exploded, killing 4 people and wounding 15 others. And while on a visit to Greece on Wednesday, Iraqi Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari acknowledged the security setback, but said the government will regain control.
It was somehow dramatic, really, for a large city like Mosul to fall and for the security forces to be melted. But I'm confident, and I've assured the minister and my colleague, that we can push back on the terrorists.
Earlier on Wednesday, the International Organization for Migration said fears of further violence in Mosul caused 500,000 people to flee their homes. It said the displaced either moved across the city or fled to other parts of Nineveh province or the neighboring Kurdish province of Erbil. In cooperation with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Kurdish regional government has set up a camp outside the checkpoint. Catherine Robinson is a public information officer for the UNHCR.
So people are coming to this checkpoint to try to get into Erbil province. Some people who don't have people waiting on the other side for them and don't have any money, the government has set up this transit camp for them so that they have a place to stay.
Hundreds of cars queued at the checkpoint on the way to Erbil on Wednesday, but only those with families or invitations from Kurds were allowed in. United States on Wednesday expressed concern about the deteriorating security situation in Iraq and pledged to help the Iraqi government fend off the rapid military advance by Sunni militants. At her Wednesday news briefing, State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki was asked about the U.S. perspective on the situation in Iraq.
We've expedited, as you know, shipments of military equipment since the beginning of the year. We've ramped up training of Iraqi security forces and worked intensively to help Iraq implement a holistic approach. As you noted, Arshad, the situation is certainly very grave on the ground.
We are working with Iraqi leaders from across the country to support a coordinated response. You can expect that we will provide additional assistance to the Iraqi government to combat the threat from ISIL, but I'm not in a position to outline that further at this point.
Psaki also said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke Wednesday by telephone with his Turkish counterpart, that is, Ahmet Davutoğlu, as well as Iraqi officials about an attack on the Turkish consulate in Mosul, where insurgents seized diplomats and children.
We join Turkey and the international community in calling for the immediate release of Turkey's kidnapped diplomatic personnel. The security reiterated the United States' commitment to working with the Iraqi government and leaders across Iraq to support a unified approach against ISIL's continued aggression. We are in touch with the governments of Turkey and Iraq and stand ready to provide any appropriate assistance.
That is U.S. reaction to events in Iraq. Russia has warned Ukraine against refusing an offer from Moscow that would cut the price Kiev pays for natural gas by 20%. President Vladimir Putin in Moscow said Wednesday that Ukraine could be driving negotiations toward a dead end by asking for deeper discounts. Russian news agencies quote Mr. Putin as saying if Ukraine refuses the deal, talks will shift to a whole other level, something he said Russia does not want. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said earlier the discount of $100 per 1,000 cubic meters is not a suitable substitute for the rewritten contract Ukraine had been seeking. Officials from both sides continue negotiations Wednesday in Brussels as they try to resolve the dispute on pricing and Ukraine's multi-billion dollar energy debt. Russia has threatened to cut off gas supplies to Ukraine, which could have effects on supplies to other parts of Europe. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has defended the swap of a U.S. soldier for five Taliban militants as the right decision made under imperfect circumstances. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Capitol Hill, where Hagel testified before the House Armed Services Committee, the first public congressional airing of the controversy surrounding the liberation of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
Secretary Hagel told lawmakers the Obama administration could have done a better job keeping Congress informed of the operation to free Bergdahl. But he doggedly defended America's duty to bring service members home and took pains to describe the intricate Qatari-mediated negotiations with the Taliban that yielded a last-minute breakthrough.
The options available to us to recover Sergeant Bergdahl were very few and far from perfect. But they often are in wartime, Mr. Chairman, and especially in a complicated war like we've been fighting in Afghanistan for 13 years. Wars are messy, and they're full of imperfect choices.
Even before Hagel spoke, the Republican Committee Chairman, Congressman Buck McKeon, dismissed the administration's justifications for the Bergdahl Taliban prisoner swap.
The explanations we received from the White House officials at a house-wide briefing earlier this week were misleading and at times blatantly false. This transfer sets a dangerous precedent in negotiating with terrorists.
On that last point, the committee's top Democrat, Representative Adam Smith, disagreed.
Any sensible person who looks at the situation in Afghanistan right now understands that there is no ultimate peaceful solution if at some point you don't negotiate with some of the Taliban. Which ones? We don't know. So to simply dismiss this as one terrorist group and negotiating with terrorists, I think totally misstates the situation.
Although conducted in a mostly business-like manner, the hearing did have moments of confrontation, like this exchange between Secretary Hagel and Republican Congressman Joe Wilson.
Safe havens are being created to attack the American people here, and action should be taken, and that would not include releasing terrorist leaders.
Congressman, there, I can assure you there's nobody more aware of that than this Secretary of Defense.
Well, please act that way, my goodness.
Secretary Hagel repeatedly said he will be in a better position to discuss many questions surrounding Bergdahl's capture and his years with the Taliban once the sergeant completes medical treatment in Germany and later in the United States. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
And it's finally here for football fans. The World Cup gets underway today in Brazil, where the host team will take on Croatia. Total of 64 matches are to be played in 12 cities across Brazil over the next month. We go now to a neighborhood near Rio de Janeiro's famed Maracana Stadium, where VOA's Scott Bob tells us football fever is high.
The weekly feira, or street market, in Vila Isabel, a working-class neighborhood near Maracana Stadium. Shoppers look for bargains. They say prices keep going up. This neighborhood was always known for its fierce football fans, says vegetable vendor Luis Henrique.
In the old days, there used to be a competition for the most decorated street, and this street won many times. There used to be so many people out on the street that you couldn't even get through.
He says people cannot afford the decorations anymore. Many are angry with the government for spending billions of dollars on stadiums while hospitals and schools are in shambles, says retired schoolteacher Vera Lucia Gatti.
So I think the money should have been spread around, some for the cup, a little for the schools, a little for the hospitals. This was the way to go, but it wasn't done that.
Some Brazilians have demonstrated against the World Cup and say they will boycott the games. Strikes by transit workers also threaten to disrupt the tournament, as is expected to draw some 800,000 foreign visitors. Some hope the international attention will lead to change in Brazil. Henrique doubts this.
You know, a country like this with so many corrupt people that you can't trust anyone, or even the most honest person in politics is on the take. There is no law. So for me, there's no solution.
Gatti says Brazil's leaders need to change.
As far as the cup goes, if Brazil wins, great. There will be happiness. I will be too, of course. But if those who govern do not change and begin to spread the wealth around, nothing will be solved.
Almost everyone here believes Brazil will win the championship, but there is little hope that this World Cup will bring anything more than temporary joy. Scott Bob, VOA News, Vila Isabel, Rio de Janeiro.
And you can keep up to date on all the action at the World Cup, and you can do it on Twitter. Check us out at VOA Football or on the internet at voafootball.com. Here's some interesting news, an interesting hire, that is, for a professional baseball team here in the United States. The Chicago White Sox have signed Olympic speed skater Eddie Alvarez to a minor league deal as an infielder. The White Sox announced the move before Wednesday night's game against Detroit. Well, it turns out that the 24-year-old Alvarez was part of a relay team at the Sochi Olympics that won the silver medal in the 500-meter relay. Alvarez was a stand-up shortstop, that is, in high school back in Miami. He missed making the Olympic skating team in 2010. Then he went on to play baseball at Salt Lake City Community College in Utah in 2011, batting .303 with 43 RBIs. Alvarez will soon begin training in Arizona. Now I see why they hired him. He knows how to play baseball as well as speed skate. Thanks, everyone, for tuning into the Voice of America and International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Altaya, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On June 12, 1987, President Ronald Reagan, speaking at the Berlin Wall in Germany, challenged the perception of Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev as a leader of peace by calling on him to take a dramatic step to prove it.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
2 years later, the Berlin Wall was torn down. On this day in 1898, rebels proclaimed independence for the Philippines after 300 years of Spanish rule. But their hopes were dashed when the United States formally annexed the archipelago as part of a treaty with Spain, ending the Spanish-American War. On this day in 1942, a young Jewish girl living in Amsterdam, Anne Frank, received a diary for her 13th birthday. For the next 2 years, Anne wrote in her diary about her family and living in hiding after the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. Eventually, the Franks were discovered and sent to a Nazi concentration camp. And while Anne Frank did not survive, the diary she wrote did. Translated into at least 30 languages, it has become the best-known memoir of the Holocaust. And on this day in 1965, the American singing group The Supremes set a music industry record that still stands today. This song became the group's fifth consecutive single to top the pop music charts. Back in My Arms Again. With hits like this one, the Supremes became America's most popular female group in the 1960s. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
3 years of conflict in Syria have taken an enormous toll on the population inside the country and beyond its borders. More than 162,000 people have been killed. Of the country's estimated pre-war population of approximately 20 million people, 9.3 million are in need of aid, with some 4 million lacking even basic necessities such as food. More than 6 million are internally displaced, refugees within their own country, while an additional more than 2.8 million have left for neighboring countries, with many living in host communities and camps. Of Syria's neighbors, Lebanon has been the most deeply impacted by the influx of refugees fleeing the violence, with over 1.1 million registered refugees from Syria. And that is one reason why Secretary of State John Kerry took the opportunity to announce during a June 4th visit to Lebanon an additional $290 million in humanitarian assistance for the Syria response, which will help people inside Syria and also the countries that host refugees who have fled the violence. With this new assistance, the United States is now providing more than $2 billion in response to this humanitarian crisis, said Secretary Kerry.
There is still an enormous need on the ground that is not being met. And I'm not going to stand up here and pretend that the $2 billion or the money we're giving today is enough. Also, for those refugees, just being supported in a refugee camp is not enough. It doesn't change their lives. It doesn't end the war. It doesn't speak to their day-to-day sense of loss and abandonment. And it certainly doesn't provide them with the long-term security and opportunity that they deserve.
All of us, all nations, have a responsibility to try to end this conflict, said Secretary Kerry, calling particularly on those nations directly supporting the Assad regime to work with the international community and bring the Syria conflict to an end. He also called on international donors to deliver to the Syrian people aid that they had pledged. It is critically important now, he said, to support Lebanon and to support others in the region who are suffering the consequences of this humanitarian crisis. I am very proud, said Secretary Kerry, that the United States of America is leading the charge and responding to this moral and this security imperative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.